We're actually in Daniel 11 tonight, but we want to start off by reading a verse from Daniel chapter 2. God controls human history. How do I know that? I know that He controls human history because He says He does. Daniel chapter 2, verses 20 through 22. Daniel said, "Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to Him. It is He who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is He who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with Him." You may be seated. God controls human history. He raises up rulers. He puts them down. It's God who determines when the times are going to change, and the times are always changing. Not only do we know that God's in control of human history because He's told us that, but God has demonstrated to us that He is in control of the events of human history. One of the ways that He has done that is where He has just told us what's going to happen ahead of time. And then it's come true. If the Lord wanted to prove to us that He controls human history, how better to do it than say, okay, well, wait 10 years and then this will happen. Daniel chapter 11 is one of the amazing places in the Bible where God just says, okay, here's what's going to happen in the future. And then He lays out all sorts of things that are supposed to happen, and every single one comes true. Daniel chapter 11, verses 1 through 35, Daniel had been praying to God for understanding about his people and what would come of the Jews in the future. And so God sent an angel, and this angel said, "Daniel, the Lord has shown me His book, His writing of truth. And in this writing of truth, God has shown me things that are to come for your people Israel." And so then he just starts to spell out for him some of the things that he's seen. There are 135 specific prophecies in Daniel 11 that have already come true. It was future to Daniel, but we know it's come true because it's past to us. And so we know that God controls human history because he said, look, here's what's going to happen in all this detail, and then that's exactly what happened. God controls human history. At the same time, when we look around, it doesn't seem like God is winning, right? I mean, we look at human history, it doesn't often seem like God is winning human history. Does it seem to you like God is winning the election process in America? Does it seem like God is winning over in the Middle East right now? Since the fall, has it ever for very long seemed in human history like God is winning? Here and there, maybe. Joseph Heller once described history as a trash bag of random coincidences torn open in a wind. And that's a pretty pessimistic view, but it is what it seems like sometimes, right? Just you open up the bag and the wind blows and that's how history's gone. One of the characters in Jane Austen's novel, Northanger Abbey, said, "History, real solemn history, I cannot be interested in. I read it a little as a duty, but it tells me nothing that does not either vex or weary me. The quarrels of popes and kings with wars and pestilences in every page. The men all so good for nothing and hardly any women at all. It is very tiresome." If we believe the Bible, we know that God controls human history. But then, if we look around, it doesn't seem like God is winning in human history. And that's not going to make sense to us unless we understand one thing. But before we get to that one thing, I want to go to Daniel 11 with you. Turn with me to Daniel chapter 11. We're going to study today the reign of one wicked king. As we go through this, just be asking yourself, say if you lived this time of this wicked king, would it seem like God is winning to you? Does it seem like God is winning? Okay, now I didn't bring my pointer, so we'll just have to hope you can see what's going on without it. But the first slide here, just quick history here to catch us up with where we're at in the book of Daniel. In the book of Daniel, there's a repeated prophecy. It comes up over and over again about five future kingdoms. Daniel lived during the first and second of these two kingdoms. Babylon, Daniel lived throughout the reign of Babylon and was there when it fell. The second kingdom that Daniel predicts, Medo-Persia. Daniel chapter 11, he's writing this in the third year of Cyrus. So he's in the second of these four kingdoms, well, the five kingdoms that are prophesied. And then Daniel predicts in his book that the next kingdom would be Greece. All of our prophecies that we'll look at today in Daniel chapter 11 happened during the time of Greece. And then God predicts through Daniel Rome. And then he predicts one final kingdom after that, the kingdom of Christ that will come and destroy these kingdoms and be in its place forever. That's the kingdom that we want, right? But here's the predictions that are made in Daniel. We're looking at that third kingdom. The kingdom of Greece is where these predictions that we're looking at today come. If you're in Daniel chapter 11, if you missed our last time that we were together, we covered the first 20 verses of this. The first thing that happens in Daniel chapter 11, maybe go to the next slide. Oh, yes. The first thing that happens in Daniel chapter 11, Persia was to fall to Alexander the Great. And that's what happens in verses 2 through 4 of Daniel chapter 11. Alexander the Great came, and he, the first leader of Greece, conquered Persia. This was Daniel's predicting it's going to happen, and it did. Daniel lived at the beginning of Persia. He's predicting what would happen at the end of it. And then, in Daniel chapter 11, verses 5 through 20, we had this, in detail, back and forth battle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Let's see what the next slide is. Oh, yes. Okay. I'm going to need a pointer. Can one of you run me a laser pointer? Thank you. When Alexander the Great died, his kingdom was broken up into four parts, and they're kind of shown here on the map in four different colors. Now, ignore all of the arrows, the funny colored arrows that are going all over this. This shows Alexander's conquering of the kingdom. I'm just showing you this because we want to focus on the green part of the map and the red part of the map today. The green part of the map is what is referred to in our text as the kings of the north. And this is the Seleucid Empire up here, up the north. And then down in the south, and this down towards Egypt, is the kings of the south. And if you were here last time, we looked at, and Daniel predicted all these things, the battles between the kings of the north and the kings of the south, and what would take place. And all of those things that Daniel predicted, hundreds of years before they happened, did happen in all kinds of detail, right? The problem, if you're a Jew in the middle of this, is that you live here. And so every time that the kings of the north sweep through on the way, they wipe you out. And when the kings of the south come back and they fight back to the north, they go through Jerusalem every time. And so there's destruction that's coming upon the people. Really, all of that history that we got last time is just setting us up so that we can get to this one particular wicked ruler. It was a ruler of the north, of the Seleucid dynasty. If you were going to list the bad guys in Jewish history, I think this bad guy's got to be at the top of the list with Hitler. Probably this man would be worse for you as in your Jewish history than even like Haman in Esther's day because of the success that he had in bringing about death for Jews. This wicked man's name is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. What's the next slide here, Rich? Oh, here's a coin of Antiochus the Fourth from his day. I guess that's what he looked like there, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And then on the coin, it says, I could have Fred read this for you, but he wouldn't want to show off. So it says, King Antiochus, and then Theos Epiphanes. This means image of God, right? Or God manifest. So he's a very humble man, Antiochus Epiphanes. My name is King Antiochus, God manifest. Down at the bottom here, you see this N-I-K. That's the first part of the word Nike, right, for victor. This is the bearer of victory. So on this coin that King Antiochus made for himself, Antiochus Epiphanes, God manifest, bearer of victory in all of his great humility. So one of the great bad guys of Jewish history. We're going to read about him today, starting in verse 21. So look there with me, Daniel 11, verse 21. In his place, a despicable person will arise, on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. In his place, we're just jumping into the middle of this. So go to the next slide that came after that, if you would, Rich. If you were here last time, you remember this. This comes out of the ESV Study Bible, really helpful little chart they've got. These guys here on the right, these are the kings of the north, the Seleucids. The guys on the left are the kings of the south, the Egyptian kings. And Daniel walked us through their lives and all of their battles back and forth and their intermarriages and all that sorts of things. He predicted hundreds of years in advance, and it happened just like he said it would. Now, we are, at the beginning of verse 20, it said, in his place, that's Seleucus here. This man has just gotten poisoned. Last place we were, this Seleucus got poisoned. And so in his place arises a despicable person. Lest we have any thought at the beginning of this, what the character of this man is going to be. Despicable, and that's a nice word for Antiochus the IV Epiphanes. In his place, he's going to arise. And it says that the kingship has not been conferred on him. And that's true. When Seleucus died, the next king that should have taken over would have been his son, Demetrius. But just before Seleucus got poisoned, his brother, Antiochus the IV Epiphanes, had been captured by the Romans and had been living there as a captive. And so feeling for his brother, who had been living in Roman captivity all of the years, he should have left him there. That would have been better. But instead of that, he sent his son to Rome as an exchange for the freeing of his brother. And so Demetrius, when Seleucus gets poisoned and is now dead, the next king who should be taking over is in Rome. And Seleucus had another son, but he's an infant. And so he's not able to take over the kingdom. So they appoint Antiochus the IV Epiphanes as kind of a co-regent. He's supposed to rule until they can get one of the rightful rulers to come in. But Antiochus never had the idea that he was just going to reign for a while and then hand off the throne. Antiochus is the true master of the art of making deals. And so what he would do is he would offer huge bribes to powerful people. And he would say, if you support me as being the king, then I'll give you this great amount of thing. And so he bribed all of the powerful people of the land so that they, basically, he just took over the kingship, even though it didn't really belong to him. Demetrius was safe because he was in Rome. The other one of Seleucus' sons, the infant, he had him murdered. And basically, Antiochus IV takes over as the king. It says in a time of tranquility there in verse 21, right? Without any need for battle, he just, by force of making deals and intimidating people, he takes over. So now he is reigning up north over the Seleucids. And he's Israel's part of his territory at this time. Okay, now verses 22 through 24 is a summary of his rule. And then in verse 25 and following, it's going to walk through some specific events of his rule. So verse 22, starting the summary, speaks of his military victories, which were great. Verse 22, it says, the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. There were overwhelmingly powerful forces that overflowed into his kingdom during the time of Antiochus, and he defeated them. Great armies came up against him, and those overflowing forces were shattered before him, turned back in defeat. It also says that he's going to shatter the prince of the covenant. That is probably referring to the high priest back down in Jerusalem when Antiochus took over. The high priest was Annas III, but Annas III preferred the Ptolemies that lived down south, and Antiochus didn't want that. And so he had him, well, actually, Annas's brother offered Antiochus some money, and so he took the money and kicked Annas out of the office. And then his other brother offered him more money. And so he took that money and kicked the other brother out of office. So essentially, the guy who should be the high priest in Jerusalem is shattered before Antiochus. He eventually ends up being killed because of Antiochus. So that's the prince of the covenant. Verse 23 continues this summary of Antiochus' reign. Verse 23, after an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception. And he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. We'll read more later about all those alliances and deceptions. But Antiochus went up. He gained power, even though his nation was a small force when he took over. It'd be his dad, Antiochus III, the Great, was a great conqueror. But towards the end of his reign, he had been defeated roundly by the Romans. And so the Antiochus' kingdom, the Seleucids, they had to be paying this heavy tax to Rome. And it was crushing. And they didn't have much of an army left after his dad got killed. But Antiochus IV, he started off with a small kingdom, and by his mastery of the art of the deal, they got more and more influential because he worked it out that way. And that's what it's saying. They grew up, they gained power, starting off with a small force of people. Verse 24 talks a little bit about how Antiochus won the support of his people. How would a despicable person get everyone to love him? Well, here's how Antiochus did it. He kind of played Robin Hood. Look at verse 24. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. So Antiochus, he would take wealth from people he didn't like, and then he would give it to powerful people. Or sometimes he'd take wealth from people from other nations, and then he would give it to the poor people of his land. And so he got them to like him by his distributing of this plunder. He worked it out in his favor. That's just a summary of his reign. It's interesting at the end of verse 24, but only for a time. See, and this is going to come up over and over again in this passage. See, God has limits. Even over this wicked, despicable man and all the harm that he's going to do for Israel, God has time limits on it. Okay, now for more specifics. We'll go down to verse 25. So talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war in verse 25. But he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. The he that's not going to stand refers to the king of the south. Go back to the map that we had earlier, Rich. Antiochus and Ptolemy the VI meet for battle. Antiochus is coming from up here in the north. Ptolemy is from Egypt. And they're continuing in the tradition of their fathers. They've just been fighting back and forth for centuries, so why would these guys not keep it up? So they both get huge armies and they go meet. They're fighting over, one of the things they want is Jerusalem and the area around it. And so they meet with these armies, and Antiochus wins a victory. Verse 25 says that the reason that Ptolemy's army, Ptolemy the VI from down south in Egypt, the reason that he fails is that schemes will be devised against him. And verse 26 says it's the fault of his advisors. It's his advisors' fault that he loses. See down in verse 26, those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, the king of the south, but many will fall down slain. Okay, now go back to slide 5 that shows, yeah. There's an interesting thing that happens here. Okay, so Antiochus IV has just had war with Ptolemy VI, right here. These two guys just battled, and Antiochus wins. The northern army wins. But Ptolemy the VI is actually Antiochus' nephew, because Antiochus' sister, Cleopatra, had gone over here and she had married Ptolemy the V. You can see the kind of dotted line drawn in there. And so Ptolemy, that just lost the battle to Antiochus, is his nephew. And as soon as Antiochus defeats him, you would think, well, he would kill him or he would treat him like a captive. But he doesn't. He treats him like royalty. And so Ptolemy VI is having a great time up north. And he's being treated like royalty. Hey, welcome. Welcome, nephew. Good to see you. You know, I'm sorry for just destroying your huge army and all. But so this is what happens. They're friends now up north. Meanwhile, back in Egypt, go back to slide 3. It's a map, I think. Okay, back in Egypt, as soon as Antiochus defeats Ptolemy the VI, the battle that they had was here at Pelusium. There it is. And the people of Egypt figure, well, since Ptolemy VI isn't around, we don't know if he's dead, we don't know if he's ever coming back, we are going to have to set up a new king. And so they choose Ptolemy the VI's brother, Ptolemy the VIII, as their king, and they set him up as king in Alexandria. Ptolemy the VIII, they all have nicknames. His name is Physcon. It's not the nickname he chose for himself. He wanted to be Euergetes, which means benefactor. They called him Physcon, which means pot-bellied. So the new pot-bellied king of Egypt is set up as the king in Alexandria, while Ptolemy VI is still up here, up north, whining and dining with Antiochus. All right. Now, it's the actions of these two kings up north that are described in verse 27. They're buddies now. Verse 27, as for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table. Someone said that's a good summary of all international relations. They will speak lies to each other at the same table. But it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. So these two kings are going to come up with a plan. Their plan is this. These two guys from up north, they're going to attack the new pot-bellied king in Alexandria, defeat him, and install Ptolemy VI as the king of Egypt. He used to be king, so he should be able to handle this, right? So they're going to swing back down, and this is good for both of them. Ptolemy VI gets his kingdom back, and Antiochus, well, since he just put the guy in place, he figures he ought to have some influence over what's going to happen down there in the south. So basically, Antiochus thinks, I'm going to reign over this whole area now once we conquer Potbelly in Alexandria, right? So that's their plan they come up with at the same table. Now they're both lying to each other. Ptolemy VI has no plans of supporting Antiochus once he gets in charge. Antiochus has no plans of supporting Ptolemy VI. They're just both grabbing for power. But it says their plan will not succeed. And it didn't. They hoped to seize all of Egypt, and they did have some success. They came down here. They actually captured Memphis, which was sort of the heart of Egypt at the time. Alexandria is where Potbelly lives, right? But they captured Memphis. But then when they went to attack Alexandria, they failed, and they were spurned and put back. And so Antiochus, he installed Ptolemy VI as the king down there in Memphis to reign in his place, kind of. And so there's competing kings in Egypt, in the Ptolemaic Empire now. Ptolemy VI, and then Potbelly up there in Alexandria. Now, I'm sure he loves me calling him that. Okay, verse 28. This is what happens after they go and they attack Egypt. Now, remember, this isn't history. Like, this isn't written down after the events to describe what's happening. This is written down 350 years before it happened to describe what's going to happen. And then it all happens, and we can just explain it because God knew it was going to happen. God controls human history. Verse 28. Then he, Antiochus, will return to his land with much plunder. He did, because he captured Memphis and a bunch of Egypt, and so he had a lot to take back. But his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land. Antiochus' pride was wounded a bit by his inability to conquer Alexandria, but his pockets are full. And as he's going through Judah on the way, there's been an uprising in Jerusalem. I told you about the priests. Onias, the real high priest, had been deposed, and this wicked puppet priest of Antiochus was in charge down there. His name was Menelaus. Well, Menelaus had killed Onias because Menelaus, to get his position, he had to promise Antiochus all this money. Where's the high priest going to get money? Well, there's a lot of wealth in the temple. So he took some of the holy things and he sold them to pay off his bribe. This is how he got to be high priest. And when he did that, the people revolted and they said, "You can't be stealing God's holy things." And especially Onias, the real high priest, was saying, "Brother, you can't be doing this." And so he kills his brother. And there's been an uprising in Jerusalem, and things are in disarray. Well, Antiochus has got this victorious army. So as he's sweeping back up from Egypt, He goes through Jerusalem, and they, with a heavy hand, restore order, right? It says his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. The Holy Covenant is just stands for God's people and the true worship that happens down there. Verse 28 predicts he will take action and then return to his own land, which is he does. He kills some people in Jerusalem, goes back up to where he's from, and restored his Menelaus to his position in high priest as high priest. They killed a bunch of Jews. They deported a bunch of Jews in the time. But for the Jews, it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. Fast forward about 2 years, and now you're in verse 29. Daniel 11:29. At the appointed time, he, Antiochus, will return and come into the south. But this last time, it will not turn out the way it did before. Surprisingly, when Antiochus goes up north, Ptolemy VI isn't faithful to him, and he joins forces with his brother Potbelly, and Potbelly and VI are co-ruling in Egypt now over the Ptolemies. And Antiochus is enraged by this lack of faithfulness. How could he do this to me? And so he gathers this army. He's going to go take out his vengeance upon VI and Potbelly and take the land over like he should have done last time, right? So that's what his plan is. He's going to return and go into the south, it says in verse 29, but it will not turn out the way it did before. Because now the Ptolemies have gotten smart, and they've gotten Rome to back them. The world superpower, Antiochus doesn't know this, but the world superpower is riding to the aid of the Ptolemies. Okay, now go down to verse 30. He's going to explain why it didn't work out so well for him. Chapter 11, verse 30. For ships of Kittim will come against him. Now, Kittim, Kittim technically refers to this island of Cyprus, but they began to use the phrase for just kind of all these areas that are around the Mediterranean Sea. And over here, of course, around the Mediterranean Sea, you have Rome. And so what happens is ships of Kittim come against Antiochus as he's coming here to try to attack Alexandria. Look at verse 30. Well, I'll tell you the story. Okay, so Antiochus he's about 4 miles from Alexandria, where Potbelly lives, and he's going to take over the country. But before he gets there, the Roman commander comes with his ships. The commander's name was Gaius Popilius Lanus. And he met Alexander 4 miles outside the city of Alexandria. The Roman commander comes up with his forces to Antiochus and all of his forces behind him. They meet out in front of their armies, you know, with flags waving. And he presents to him a letter from the Roman Senate. And the letter says, if you invade Egypt, consider it war against Rome. Well, Antiochus' dad had fought against Rome, and that hadn't gone very well for him. And so he's standing here in front of his whole army trying to decide what he's going to do. Is he going to press ahead and attack the Ptolemies and then fight against Rome or what? And he's kind of delaying. And so the Roman general who hands him this letter from the Senate, he takes a stick and he draws a circle around the king, you know, like, and he says, okay, now I need an answer before you step outside of the circle. Antiochus, you know, he's got issues with humility, right? This is not his thing. And so he's standing there. And he's like, okay, I'll go back home, right? And so he decides not to attack the Ptolemies. And in front of everyone, he gets shamed because he's not willing to fight. He brought this huge army down here to take over Egypt, and now he's just going to slink off home. Well, that's what's happening here. Verse 30, for ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened and will return. And on the way back, who do you think he's going to take off his anger on? Well, the Jews are there, right? And become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Again, the Holy Covenant refers to all things religious. It refers to the faithful Jews back in Jerusalem. And these Jews are made to bear the brunt of Antiochus' frustration. His chief tax collector came ahead of his army into the city of Jerusalem under the guise of peace, promising peace to them. But on the Sabbath, he suddenly attacked and massacred many people, plundered the city of Jerusalem. The unfaithful Jews, the ones who were siding with Menelaus and with Antiochus, those guys got favors. But for the faithful Jews, it was bad. Look at verse 31. Forces from him, Antiochus, will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice. And they will set up the abomination of desolation. See, Antiochus decides now, because these Jews, every time he goes through here, they're revolting about something, and they always think they got to be so different. Why can't they just be like all the rest of us and worship our gods? He decides, I'm going to make these Jews toe the line. And so he has several things that he does. First, he pollutes the temple. It says he desecrates the sanctuary fortress. Well, he did that in many ways. He plundered what was left of its holy things and took them back with him up north. He set up a gymnasium right outside of the temple where the athletes were training naked for Greek games, which was against Jewish sensibilities. Be against my sensibilities too. And also, worse than that, he defiled the temple by the blood of innocent Jews that he slaughtered all around it. Second thing it says that he does, he'll do away with the regular sacrifice. Let me read to you the Jewish perspective on this. Their Jewish history book of 1 Maccabees tells about what happens when he did away with the regular sacrifice. Verse 41 says, then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and that all should give up their particular customs, like worshiping Yahweh. All the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many, even from Israel, gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the towns of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and festivals, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and other unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by every unclean thing and profane, so that they would forget the law and change all the ordinances. He added, "And whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die." So for the Jews in Jerusalem at this time, if you were caught with a copy of the scriptures, you were killed. If you circumcised your son was killed, and you were killed. The entire law of Moses is outlawed at this time. Antiochus says, okay, you just cannot be a Jew anymore. It'd be like the United States saying, well, look, if you get caught with the Bible, or if you get baptized, or if you celebrate communion, you sing a song about Jesus, you pray to Jesus, you're dead. Well, what would we do? On top of outlawing Jewish religion, Antiochus and his cronies required the Jews to participate in the worship of pagan gods. So you couldn't just go home and secretly worship God. They forced you to publicly worship the false gods. One of the false gods they set up in the temple itself. Is there a slide after this? Slide 6? Yeah, thanks. Here's a picture of the temple. Look in verse 31. It says, they will set up the abomination of desolation. Maybe you say, well, the abomination of desolation, I thought that was something that the Antichrist was going to set up in the end times, in the future tribulation. Yes, he is going to come and set up an abomination of desolation, but there was one in the past as well. In fact, there's a lot of ways when you look at Antiochus' epiphanies and you look at the Antichrist, they parallel one another. Antiochus IV is kind of a evil prefiguring of the greatest evil man of all time who's yet to come. Well, so what they did in the courtyard in front of Solomon's temple, there was a large bronze altar right here where they're offering burnt offerings. This is how you're supposed to worship. But Antiochus came in, they stripped the temple of its gold and treasures, and took those off north. And here they set up an altar of Zeus, the Greek god, and demanded that he be worshipped. They would sacrifice on Antiochus' birthday day every month. They would sacrifice pigs on the altar, and the Jews were to come and join in with the worship of this. Okay, imagine you're a Jew in that day. Does it seem like God is winning? You know, we say God's in control of human history, but does it seem right now like God is winning? Antiochus could not have dishonored God any more than he did. He did as much as he could know to do. He couldn't have opposed God's people more than he did. Anybody who did what was right and worshiped God, he'd kill them. And it just seems like God is doing nothing. Some of the Jews must have been at home whispering back and forth to each other, you know, our God, we read the story of Daniel, but in Daniel, you know, he rescued them from the lions and from the fire. Maybe God isn't really holy. Maybe our God's not really loving and powerful like we were told. And that's exactly what Antiochus was telling them. Your God's no different. Look at verse 32. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. So there's two responses in Jerusalem. There are those who act wickedly towards the covenant. They're not going to be faithful to God. They're Jews like Menelaus. And okay, sure, I'll worship your idols, Antiochus. For them, he rewards them. But there are some who say, no, I'm going to be faithful to my God, that are going to display strength and take action. True believers. Look down to verse 33. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. You see, there's going to be some, and there were, we're looking back now, Daniel's predicting it ahead of time, we're looking back on it, there were some who were teachers in Israel, and they stood up and reminded others, hey, look, we need to be faithful to our God and to His Word. And yet, of those who stood, many were killed with Antiochus' swords, others were burned alive. Many were carried away as captives to other places, had their possessions plundered, and this went on, it says in verse 33, for many days. Let me read to you an account again from the Jewish history book, Second Maccabees this time, of something that happened in this day. It tells the story of a mother and her seven sons who were there with the king and refusing to eat the things they were forcing upon them, pagan sacrifices. It happened also that seven brothers and their mother were arrested, Jewish people, and were being compelled by the king under torture with whips and thongs to partake of unlawful swine's flesh. One of them, acting as their spokesman, said, "What do you intend to ask and learn from us? For we are ready to die rather than transgress the laws of our ancestors." The king fell into a rage and gave orders to have pans and cauldrons heated. These were heated immediately, and he commanded that the tongue of the spokesman be cut out, and that they scalp him and cut off his hands and feet, while the rest of the brothers and the mother looked on. When he was utterly helpless, the king ordered them to take him to the fire, still breathe him, and to fry him in a pan. The smoke from the pan spread widely, but the brothers and their mother encouraged one another to die nobly, saying, "The Lord God is watching over us, and in truth he has compassion on us, as Moses declared in his song that bore witness against the people to their faces when he said, 'And he will have compassion on his servants.'" After the first brother died in this way, they brought forth the second for their sport. They asked him, "Will you eat rather than have your body punished limb by limb?" He replied in the language of his ancestors and said to them, "No." Therefore he in turn underwent tortures as his first brother had done. And when he was at his last breath, he said to the king, "You accursed wretch, you dismiss us from this present life, but the king of the universe will raise us up to an everlasting renewal of life because we have died for his laws." After him, the third was the victim of their sport. When it was demanded, he quickly put out his tongue and courageously stretched forth his hands and said nobly, "I got these from heaven, and because of his laws I disdain them, and from him I hope to get them back again." As a result, the king himself and those who were with him were astonished at the young man's spirit, for he regarded his sufferings as nothing. Okay, the chapter keeps going. I'll skip over it, right? It goes through each brother. Antiochus felt that he was being treated with contempt, and he was suspicious of the mother's tone. The youngest brother still being alive, Antiochus not only appealed to him in words, but promised him with oaths that he would make him rich and enviable if he would turn from the ways of his ancestors, and that he would take him for his friend and entrust him with public affairs. Since the young man would not listen to him at all, the king called the mother to him and urged her to advise the youth to save himself. After much urging on his part, she undertook to persuade her son. Leaning close to him, she spoke in their native language as follows, "My son, have pity on me. I carried you 9 months in my womb and nursed you for 3 years and have reared you and brought you up to this point in your life and have taken care of you. I beg you, my child, to look at the heaven and the earth and see everything that is in them and recognize that God did not make them out of things that existed. And in the same way the human race came into being, do not fear this butcher, but prove worthy of your brothers. Accept death so that in God's mercy I may get you back again along with your brothers." And so it keeps going. So the brother stands and he doesn't give in. And the mother then stands and doesn't give in, and they kill them all. You get a picture of how horrible this was. Right? Antiochus is bound and determined that there's going to be nothing left of this Jewish religion, of these people who worship this God. They're going to be Greek, whether they like it or not. Verse 34, "Now when they fall, they'll be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy." This refers to the Maccabean revolt that happens after this. It came at the end of Antiochus' reign. Judas Maccabees is a great story to read. His five sons, they rebel against Antiochus. They end up defeating him and restoring Jerusalem, taking Jerusalem out of his wicked hands back into the kingdom of the Jews. To the point where there were Jews that had been unfaithful that now are pretending to be faithful so that they can be part of God's kingdom again. Right? That's what it says. Many will join with them in hypocrisy. Verse 35, "Some of those who have insight will fall, in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end of time, because it is still to come at the appointed time." This theme just it goes through here, right? It kept going, but it wasn't time. It wasn't time yet. The time ran out. God is controlling these horrible things of human history. He's moving along on his time scale. Now, if the Jews of that day had access to Daniel, and some of them did, these words must have been encouraging to them that an end to Antiochus' persecutions was going to come, and it did. But the purging of Israel that was going on in that day is still continuing today. And it's going to continue until the Jews finally, as is prophesied, until the Jews as a whole finally come and receive their Messiah. It says in Romans, all Israel will be saved. There's going to be a time when the Jews as a whole turn to Christ and their purging will come to its end. If you look at the history of this period and the life of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, does it seem like God is winning? Does it seem like there's any real winners in this story? I mean, we read through not just his reign, but the reigns of the kings that came before him. Antiochus certainly does not come out on top. Antiochus died in agony, according to one account, calling out to the God of Israel to preserve his life. It wasn't much of an answer there, right? It's hard to say here that the Jewish people as a whole came out of the chapter as winners. But I would argue that there are some true winners that are hitting in this text. They show up in verse 33, and they show up in verse 35. There's similar language about them in both verses. Look at verse 33. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword and by flame. And then verse 35, some of those who have insight will fall. Now, on the surface, you say, well, what kind of insight did they have? Their wisdom didn't seem to do them much good. They're all dying. Or many of them are dying, but their insight brings about their death. And you say, well, what insight was it that these people had that caused them to willingly die for their God and for his commands? Look over to Daniel chapter 12, verse 2. The phrases about these people with insight show up again here. Daniel chapter 12, verse 2. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. What insight do you have to make sense of human history when it seems like everything's spinning out of control? What insight do you have to have? The insight you have to know that there will be a resurrection. This is the insight that these people had. This is why they were willing to give their lives up. They knew that there was going to be a resurrection, some to eternal life and some to eternal condemnation. And so those who had insight, and we read it here in the off the lips of this ancient story, right? I'll give my life up because I know that God's going to give it back to me. This is the insight that they had that enabled them to stand. This is the insight that we have to have when we're looking at human history and we say, well, God, if you're in control of human history, it doesn't seem like you're winning. But the truth is, it really doesn't matter who wins down here right now. What really matters is when you stand before Christ in the day of resurrection, what will his evaluation of you be? This is really the only thing that matters. What matters? Who wins? It's when I stand before Christ, if he says, you trusted in me, I've given you life, well done, my good and faithful servant, then I'm a winner no matter what happened in my life. If I gain the whole world, and then I die in the resurrection and stand before Christ and he says, depart from me, you worker of iniquity, then I am not a winner. I don't care what happened in this life. This is the insight that we have to understand how it is that God is in control of human history and can be winning in the midst of this. So God is in control of human history. I mean, he's proven it to us. He predicted all of these things 350 years before they happened, and now we can look back and say, yep, phrase by phrase, it all came true. Doesn't seem like God is winning unless you understand one thing. A resurrection is coming for every man. And that's the thing that matters. Let's pray. God, thank you for the insight that you've given to us. We wouldn't know this unless you had told us that there's more to life than this life. And you're doing things with this life, Lord. You have plans for Israel. You have plans for your church. You have plans to come back and restore this world to what it ought to be, make it new again. But we can be discouraged as we look around, Lord, by all the things that seem to go against what you would want, against your will. And people do harmful things, and you allow suffering around us. But Lord, we know that there's an eternal perspective we have to have. Will you give that to us this week? Remind us of the resurrection. Remind us of what matters for us and what matters for the people around us that need so desperately to know of Christ so that they can be ready for that day. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.